Hello, it's me, Joe Devine, from the Movies You Forgot podcast. Just dropping a quick editor's note in here to let you know that at the end of last week's episode, Logan Lucky, we decided to watch the film Philomena. Now, that's a lovely film, and we did actually record a whole episode about that film, which we greatly enjoyed. But because we're both deeply, deeply stupid men, we messed up the recording, and it was not salvageable. Also, we're the kind of men that wouldn't and couldn't redo what we did because we thought it was so, you know, the best thing we'd ever done, that to do it again would just be to make it worse than that. And we're, you know, we really just strive for greatness in all areas of our lives, as you can tell from listening to other episodes of the podcast. So instead, we did the heroes thing, which was to just abandon it after all the hard work we'd done. We just abandoned it for your sake and for ours. And instead, we just are jumping to the next episode. So at the end of the fabled Philomena episode, great episode, really good. Shame you couldn't hear that one. At the end of that, we decided to watch the film Sunshine, which is a Danny Boyle movie, and that's what today's episode is about. So if you're confused and you're going, scratching your head and thinking, hey, where's Philomena? I liked that film. I wanted to hear them talk about it. Well, guess what? You can't, on account of our lack of attention to detail. So sorry about that, and you're welcome. But for now, I'll leave you to enjoy Sunshine with Danny Boyle. He's not here. With Adam Richmond.
Well, I was just listening to the DVD commentary of The Cable Guy with Judd Apatow, Ben Stiller and Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
This was years... They recorded this years after the film, so they're very like aware of how it flopped. And I think it would have been around the time they mention I Love You, Philip Morris.
Yeah.
So that's 2009. So yeah, so like it was probably around 2010. So it's well over 15 years and they're reflecting on it. And in between Jim Carrey commenting on the attractiveness of various women in the film,
ew,
which is a bit odd, he just sort of says how being funny and being successful in Hollywood, you need to have this emptiness inside. You need to be filling the void. And so being happy, trying to be happy and being successful basically doesn't work. And the reason why he's kind of sort of saying he has found inner joy and he filled that void. You know, he's quite, you know, when you sort of see him when he's got his beard on talk shows and
he strikes quite a Letterman aesthetic now, doesn't he?
Yeah, and this is, he's already doing this, he was doing this 10 years ago, and yeah, it's just it suddenly made me really sad because I'm old and trying to achieve something, you know, and that's because of, you know, the void inside, and he's basically sort of saying don't, you know, the idea of trying success and achieving something is all basically this horrible thing that you're trying to fill and fix yourself.
So do you think there's a balance then, to take it back to what we were saying before? Do you think like there's a middle ground? Because often, even in films, these two states of being are set against each other very regularly. We talked about this in previous episodes, but the notion that for a protagonist to achieve their individual goal, that might be set against their family goal, their collective goal. And it's a bit of a cliche, but often, you know, the spouse of the lead within the film is saying, you don't spend enough time here or at home, you're ignoring your family in order to further your individual goal. And those two things are very set against each other. Now, of course, they would be if lots of artists feel this way, because it's the artists that are writing the films. And so they're really just reflecting maybe their own experiences. But it is kind of a common thread, isn't it?
It is. But then when you're listening to the commentary, like Judd Apatow and Ben Stiller both sound so well adjusted. And Judd Apatow in particular, he seems like a pretty grounded, nice guy.
He's but are they transcendent artists, Adam?
But he's
those
not,
two guys are like fantastic professionals, right? And like no, not a bad word to say about them. But Jim Carrey is something otherworldly.
Exactly. So yeah, and he was. So I think maybe, and Carrey was talking about particularly in front of the camera star quality. Although Ben Stiller is very funny.
For sure.
In Zoolander. But that's the thing, we don't get to see Jim Carrey. Jim Carrey doesn't do Ace Ventura, Dumb and Dumber type stuff anymore. And I think it's because
I'm sure it's because of a lifetime of being, you know, when someone... The thing with Jim Carrey's funniest moments, they're not... In some ways, they're not dissimilar to someone we've talked about recently, Adam Sandler, not putting them up next to each other. But I would say that Jim Carrey is funny in a kind of extremely surreal and at 10 way, right? And people, when they bump into him in the street, they would expect him to be like that. He's not like a stand-up comedian who's very witty and dry and who could replicate that with like low energy and ease. He is someone who you expect to kind of see crawling around the street on all fours and just making weird shapes with his mouth and moaning, you know, like that's when he's at his best. So I imagine like people's expectations of him over the course of a couple of decades has probably, you know, worn him away from doing that.
Yeah, I imagine any time, I guess anyone who's particularly associated with that kind of thing, they want, I guess certainly comedians, it's like, do that thing, perform, be that person for me. But then also then he does get his, you know, he gets his Truman Show, he gets
Eternal Sunshine, Snap. He does that other one as well. What's that?
He's really good. It was a Frank Darabont film called The Majestic.
That's the one I'm thinking of, yeah.
Yeah, and it absolutely died on its ass.
Yeah.
Because it's about a 3-hour film and it's kind of I don't know what to say, it's anti-American, but it's very anti the communist witch hunts. And it's surprisingly about something. I tell you what, that's a movie people forgot they forgot, and we should probably do a deep, deep dive on that.
Adam is the host now. The dynamic works better when Adam is the host. Adam prefers to be the host, and Joe prefers to be the participant. It's better overall when Adam is the host, and Joe is the participant. Let it never be spoken of again. The ghost. 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 The ghost.
Hello, and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmond, and joining me as ever is the old leaky little bucket man with a hole in the bottom of his bucket, and he's put his bucket under the tap of cinema and it's filling up to the top and it all just falls out the bottom and down his trousers. Mister?
This is what you want me to say, my own name again?
Yeah.
Joe Devine.
There he is.
Hello.
I thought you'd just hop right on there.
No, that's fine. I feel like you're sort of training me like a dog to say my own name.
This is the podcast in which we talk about the movies we forgot we'd even seen in the first place. On today's episode, we are talking about the 2007 flick directed by Danny Boyle, Sunshine.
Sunshine.
107 mins.
Yeah.
Which stacks up to be about an hour and 40 mins,
sure.
If you want to do it that way.
Yeah.
Written by Alex Garland, which is important and interesting. And here comes the letterboxed, what's the film about?
Hit me.
If the sun dies, so do we. 50 years into the future, the sun is dying and Earth is threatened by Arctic temperatures. A team of astronauts is sent to revive the sun, but the mission fails. 7 years later, a new team is sent to finish the mission as mankind's last hope, which is very much what the film is about.
Yeah, okay.
So this is very much sci-fi. It's my wheelhouse. Oh, the old wheelhouse of sci-fi.
Yeah.
You know, I know some people, quite a lot of people, in fact, who basically will dismiss sci-fi out of hand.
Who are those people?
I think they're just most people.
What?
Do you not?
I've heard of these people. I've heard of them, but I've never met one.
They exist, and guess what? They're the norms.
Yeah, I've never really met anyone, I don't think, who would discount it out of hand, although perhaps I'm not having this, you know, enough conversations about it. It's my favourite genre.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things about sci-fi. It's a Chilly McBilly genre, I think, in some regards. I think Star Wars has done serious damage to sci-fi.
So if Star Wars isn't a sci-fi, what is it, Adam?
Well, I consider it to be a space opera.
Oh.
It's space fantasy, and that's fine. And partly I find it amusing. It amuses me to do that in a conversation, to be the pedant and then dig into, you know, what is sci-fi. The problem is someone then says, well, what's sci-fi? And then I go,
it's in space with lasers.
And I say, no, it's not that. I say, I like to think sci-fi is about a...
Sci-fi is about ideas. That's the thing about sci-fi. Sci-fi can't, you know, like, it can't just be set in space, right? It has to be based around an idea. And in this, there's an idea, sort of, in this film.
No, not sort of. There is an idea in here. The sci-fi of the question is, what if the sun was dying... and you know, what happens to the people who have to go on the mission? The Star Wars factor, I think, puts people off sci-fi because it, you know, people would dismiss that out of hand.
Sure, it's Lord of the Rings in space.
It's silly, and it's spaceships, and I want something a bit more authentic, and I want human relationships. I think, I think most people want stuff that's relatable, and. Most of science fiction isn't. They don't think it is anyway. It's just not their cup of tea.
Now, this is funny to me, though, because the last time I remember us having a conversation like this was during the episode in which we talked about The Life of Pi. And in that episode, I don't know if you remember, but you told me in no uncertain terms that you hate allegories and you hate anything that's allegorical, you know? Now, I'm not saying that sci-fi is all allegorical, but sci-fi is certainly symbolic of relatable human issues set in unrelatable environments.
I disagree. Sci-fi isn't allegorical. There's an idea. It's a what if. That's not an allegory. That's how would you respond?
It's a relatability allegory.
No, it's not. It's how. What would you do? Like, for example, what would you do? What's one of my favorite sci-fis?
Children of Men.
That's not one of my favourite sci-fis.
Well, it's my favourite.
Okay, will you tell me what Children of Men is about?
Okay, Children of Men is a metaphor for a world that doesn't love its children anymore.
No, it's not. It's Children of...
I was trying to think on my feet.
Children of Men is an interesting example of a sci-fi because it doesn't have a lot of the trappings of sci-fi, and I think that's why a lot of people that snuck through the net.
Right. It's a sneaky one where people go, this just looks like a nice film.
Well, this looks like a post-apocalyptic film.
Yeah.
Which people like to imagine, you know, what the world would be like if it all goes tits up.
Sure.
Which is a sci-fi of a sort, you know, but...
What about Moon? You like Moon?
I love Moon. So yeah, that's a great example. That's in space. Chilly McBilly.
Yeah.
What if there's a guy looking after a moon unit on the moon?
What if Kevin Spacey was a robot?
The film's called Moon. And then what if you wake up and then you realise actually. They've been cloning you, and you're just a clone of another astronaut. And what does that do to your state of mind and your sense of self?
Yeah,
I am obsessed. I love clone movies. Love them.
Yeah,
I love what they're about. They're not allegorical or symbolic. They are specifically about identity and what does it do to your sense of self? You know, on a human level, on an emotional level, to know that there's another one of you who is basically thinks the same as you and has the same background. What does that do to you? Are you who you are?
Well, of course. Yeah, no,
I agree. What are we made of?
I know you love clone movies, and they've made a big part of your life, right? But what you're saying, forget allegories, right? But just in Life of Pi, you were shouting about symbols. Why must everything be symbolic? Why can't they just say what it is? You were ranting and raving about it. You were shouting and kicking things over and saying, why can't you just say, why isn't everything literal? You know, but your description there is perfect of what you love clone movies because you, I assume someone who has various identity issues, you've really locked on to the clones and these stories that come with clones as a means of exploring your own, you know, identity related issues. And that's all symbolic, isn't it? It's just it finds a sort of different surreal environment in order to be reflective about you know, emotional states that aren't surreal, that are very real. And that's my favorite thing about sci-fi. That's why I love, you know, all of the sci-fi, science fiction writers, authors that emerged from the Soviet Union during and just before the Cold War, because they were literally forced to critique their local and national politics through these very amusingly covert stories that were set on different planets in order for them to be able to critique a political system that they weren't allowed to have free speech to critique. They had to set it on, you know, on the moon or whatever.
Yeah, but I don't like that sci-fi. I tried to read the Stragatsky brothers and it's right. boring. You know, I'm more of a...
Moon. You're more of a moon guy.
I'm more of a Philip K. Dick guy.
Right.
Which is
You
not...
liked it, that one with the dog?
No, because that's a really bad... Philip K. Dick is a bad writer.
Yeah.
He can't do sim...
It's because he's not forced by his political system to cloak what he's trying to say. He just says whatever he wants and it's rubbish.
Yeah, he's taken acid and he's paranoid. And
yeah.
He's writing stories about being paranoid and going... They're literally about, you know, what they say they are.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't back that up because I haven't read them in a while.
Don't worry, we all know you can't, but it's still interesting.
I feel like I wanted to say that and I said it.
Yeah.
And whether that's true or not, hey.
No, I'm glad you said it. Yeah.
And I'm happy to be corrected on the matter. I'm all about learning. And I'm glad that you feel that you've won a point over me. Danny Boyle, the director, talks about the titans, the three titans of not sci-fi particularly, but the three titans of the space, a spaceship film.
Yeah.
Can you guess what three films were the titans and that would always were the three films that were looming over this for Danny Boyle?
They have to be set on a spaceship.
Yes.
Well, is one of them Alien?
Well, bingo.
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 Bingo outside and think of two other films. Okay.
One of them is Russian and the other one is, you really have to get.
Is the Russian one Solaris?
Yes.
Okay.
Look at you.
Yeah.
Two for two. And
Thank
the
you.
Third one for you is a slam dunk.
It's a slam dunk for me.
Yeah.
As you in don't. I like the film.
Come on. Space.
I'm trying to think of other space films now.
Space. It's Big Space Man.
It's
the big space film.
Space Man. It's the big space. Oh, you must be talking about Independence Day.
It's 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Oh, it's 2001. Yeah. Do you know what? I wasn't even. I would never have got that in a million years because all I can think of is like locked between 1985 and 2005.
Ever since we had a digression on this podcast where you debated about me calling it 2000 and whatever.
Yeah.
I now say, you know, 2001, you know, all the way to 2009.
Yeah.
And I did that in the office. Someone called me up on it and said, what? I said, oh, yeah, it came out in 2007. He said 2007. I said, well, think about it. Are you saying 1900? Were you saying 1999? No, you weren't, were you?
Yeah.
Are you saying 2010? And then he went, oh, actually. And then we started talking about, oh, yeah, maybe what? Yeah, what were you doing in 2010? Yeah, maybe.
No, that's because there were a couple of years there where people continued in the format before they moved across.
And then
2012 was the first year.
There you go. This is exactly what we agreed upon. Yep. 2012.
Yeah, it's because it's true.
And that's when it changed. So now I've called the film, you know, for like an in-joke, 2001, and you've instantly called it 2001.
I know. Yeah? The thing is, that's our joke, isn't it? At the, you know, when we're talking about the date of a film, we say that, and that's funny. But then I wouldn't say that in the office. I'd say 2001 because I don't wish to have that exchange. I'm glad that you did, though, and I'm really glad that you came to... you know, you made him question himself.
I think I looked insane.
Yeah.
So those are the Titans.
There's three mega movies right there.
And then he gets onto the key. There are three things that you establish in one of these kinds of films in the opening act. And every single one of these films has it. A spaceship in danger, things going wrong, and it's the ship. You establish the ship, the crew, and then the mysterious signal, and that's it. He calls it out and he's like, oh yeah, that's right, that's what every single one of these films have.
Yeah,
you have a ship, you have a crew, and then you have a mysterious signal.
Yeah,
and then that's the genre, and then within that, then it gives you room to play with theme and character, and you know,
aesthetic,
you can have
style, yeah,
exactly, and then you can do whatever you want. Anyway, that's what I like about genre.
Do you know the main thing I forgot about this film, Adam, is anyone who was in the film, which surprised me, because
it's a hell of a cast.
It's an incredible. Do you know what? It's an incredible cast, and I think it's a mixture of two things. I have a very strong memory of the film because it scared me the first time I watched it, and I watched it just the once. But also,
When did you watch it at the cinema? Sorry to...
I think I must have watched it at the cinema because it came out in 2007, as discussed. It's possible I watched it on DVD. It'd be right on the edge of my ability to walk down the road and go and see it. So it is possible that I watched it on DVD. But either way, it scared me. And I think also it would have been before I knew who many of these people were. So watching it back now, some 16 years later, not only thinking, wow, this is quite the cast, but also kudos to Danny Boyle and their casting director and team for assembling this group of actors, because all of them nearly have gone on to like quite incredible things since then. Cillian Murphy, I completely forgot I was in the film, which is funny because I definitely knew who he was. And 28 Days Later is one of my favourite films of all time. So, you know, him in a Danny Boyle movie is not a mystery to me.
No. And I think there's also a reason why you forget he's in this, and Boyle talks about it. You barely see, you hear his voiceover at the beginning. Yeah. And oh, by the way, before we get on to this, the opening voiceover is Cillian Murphy explaining the plot of the film. And he says, 8 astronauts on a ship attached to the back of a bomb I designed. And immediately I thought, hang on a sec, you've just come out in a film where you've made a bomb.
Oh,
he's Oppenheimer.
16 years before, he's blowing up the sun.
He loves playing characters who make bombs.
Yeah, and there's that scene in 28 Days Later, isn't there, where he sneaks in behind the zombie in the house and lets it off the chain, lets it loose into the house, and that's kind of like a bomb.
It's a zombie bomb.
It's a zomb bomb.
But the first key scene where you see everyone on the ship talking, the one person that you don't see is the person who's going to make the call.
Yeah.
Danny Ball really thinks about things. He's seeing all the other actors and they're all talking about, shall they go and see the other ship? Shall they go and see the other ship? That's a fucking tongue twister. And he only cuts to the star, ostensibly, of the movie, Cillian Murphy, when he is referred to. It doesn't establish him in the scene at all. And it just cuts to him when he's going to be the one who has to make the decision. And like Danny Boyle is basically perfectly happy to bury the lead.
Yeah.
Which I find, you know, Danny Boyle makes interesting creative directorial decisions that don't necessarily all pay off.
The man knows how to scramble his eggs.
He's making them.
Yeah.
He's making these. He's thinking about it. He's trying to achieve something. And I think that's fantastic.
I think that too. Well done, Danny Boyle. You know, also, that voiceover at the beginning of the film is absolutely terrific. Oh. Like the cadence of it, the all of the pacing, the delivery, the way that it's quiet and subtle, the way that the sound has been mixed as well, like the mastering is phenomenal. It's such a good opening voiceover, and it's so gentle and quiet and intimate, and like it just brings you instantly into the tone of the film. I loved that bit at the beginning. It's a shame the film goes a bit mental later on, but
hey, look, we don't need to foreshadow that yet. But yeah, imagine Bruce Willis reads the same text.
Oh God, yeah.
I love Bruce Willis,
sure,
but imagine it. You know,
7 years ago, the Icarus Project sent a mission to restart the sun, but that mission was lost before it reached the star. 16 months ago, I, Robert Capa, and a crew of 7 left Earth frozen in a solar winter.
Our payload, a stellar bomb with the mass equivalent to Manhattan Island. Our purpose, to create a star within a star. 8 astronauts strapped to the back of a bomb. My bomb. Welcome to Icarus 2.
I mean, do you know what?
Sorry.
It doesn't sound anything like Bruce Willis.
Absolutely not.
But I liked it. I really enjoyed it.
Our sun is dying. Mankind faces extinction. 16 months ago, I, Robert Capa, and a crew of 7 left Earth frozen in a solar winter. Our mission, reignite the sun before it's too late. Welcome to Icarus 2.
Rose Byrne is in this film, as Jeez, is Chris great. Evans. They're both very good.
Hey, look, every time you say a name, just give me room to say okay. Hot diggity, all right?
Let's try that again then. Rose Byrne is in the film.
Oh, she's so good in this.
She's terrific. As is Chris Evans.
He's also fantastic.
I like it when he dies in the coolant. Also, Hiroyuki Sanada is in this film, who is from The Last Samurai, as well as many other recognisable films, and also a couple of video games that I've played and seen him in. So I feel very familiar around Hiroyuki. Also, Michelle Yeoh is in this film, who has since won an Oscar for her performance in Everything Everywhere All at Once a couple of years ago. And she's also in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Crazy Rich Asians, plus Benedict Wong, who went on to success in those films with Benedict Cumberbatch. The two Benedicts together. Can't remember what they're called, though. The Marvel movies.
Yeah, he pops up in Doctor Strange. It's a fantastic cast. I mean, these films rely on your team. I mean, the film that it reminds me of the most, and it's so similar to, it's a 1997 flick called Event Horizon.
Yeah.
Directed by Paul W.S. Anderson.
It is quite Event Horizon-y.
Oh, yeah. Have you seen it?
I watched it for the first time in the last 12 months.
It's quite scary, isn't it?
It is quite scary. It's on the sort of scarier edge of things that I would watch. And similarly, had I watched it at the age I was when I first watched Sunshine, I think I might have shat the bed for a year. But now I'm an old man. I mean, it doesn't really scare me anymore.
We see, that's the flaw that both these films have is they get really, really silly, and they both involve a flayed man.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's a bit baffling that this film kind of goes so bad, like, so quickly.
It's completely baffling.
Because same thing happens to Event Horizon. Sam Neill is the baddie in that, and he goes all mad, and it's...
He goes all Sam Neill-y.
Yeah, that is a ship that opens up a door, a gate accident, a gateway to hell, you know, like you do.
Yeah.
And it all gets a bit bondagey in S and M-E. for this, like, unfortunately, because I think the strictures of the genre means, and you think that you could end the film better, I want you to pitch me how you think this film could be better, but only change the ending, the last act, because I think everything, all the setup, you've got to have that.
Yeah, I keep all the setup.
Alex Garland's written, you know, he obviously wanted to write this kind of film, so the setup is exactly the same. You've got the Icarus 2. No, they're on Icarus 2. They get the call to go and see the other ship. They've got to do all those things, and they still have to deliver the payload.
Sure.
What is the extra, you know, fly in the ointment? In Alien, it's an alien.
Yeah.
You know, what is it in 2001? It's the ship's computer goes mad.
Yeah.
Right? And there you go. I've re-remembered that.
Yeah.
So it's got to be, and I'm explaining what writing is to you.
You're asking a very, very long question.
Joe, I want you to tell me how you rewrite this. Everything's got to be the same, okay?
The setup is all the same. Here's what I do. I'll even
Wait a minute, wait.
Yeah.
It's got to come from the ship that they go and try and save.
Yeah.
Great,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm no slouch. I know.
You know.
I've seen an egg. I've looked at the egg. I've cracked open an egg. I know what happens inside of an egg. You know what I'm saying? It's slimy in there. And this movie's going to be slimy as well. I'll keep Mark Strong, right? But Mark Strong never...
Explain who Mark Strong is.
Mark Strong plays the captain of the first Icarus mission that went missing 7 years, 6.5 years before. And Mark Strong in this version of the film, the one that actually exists, is a kind of a scary villain guy who has gone completely mad and believes that he's been talking to God for 7 years and his entire body is burned. He breaks onto the new ship and he causes all kinds of haywire nonsense and tries to stop them from doing their mission, right? And that's essentially who they're fighting against for the second half of the film. I would
it all becomes a bit, you know, like we've got to get to the place to turn the key,
yeah,
to get on the ship, to fire the bomb. It all becomes very, very like,
The thing that irritates me about it is that it builds this incredible idea, right? And it spends an hour doing that. And it builds towards the idea that what happened to the other ship could happen to this ship. But we don't know what happened to the other ship until we see a video recording when they make birth on the original ship, and there's Mark Strong. He's recorded a video. He's clearly gone a bit mad. They find the crew in the observation room where they've taken up all of the protection and they've all burned themselves alive, and clearly everyone either went crazy or one person did and caused something horrible to occur. Now, in my mind, at this point in the film, this is then what could happen to the crew of Icarus 2. What the film does is it brings the mental guy from the first ship to come and do that for them. What I would do is Mark Strong would never be allowed to leave the video, right? He's dead 6 years ago. At the point in which the two ships break apart, so when Icarus 2 finds Icarus 1, they dock, they have the famous airlock scene, which is in all of these spaceship movies, a few people go through, and then there's some like crazy damage to the airlock, which means that it's going to be very difficult to get back, and there'll be casualties and whatever. And there's our first instinct, right? There's our first moment where the standing captain of the mission makes a decision where he wants to go back instead of the person who should clearly be going back, instead of our hero, Cillian Murphy. And that's the point at which the fabric of the crew starts to break apart, right? With a writer as clever and good as Alex Garland, you could achieve all of this social fabric breaking apart, and you can do it with just the reflection and the symbol and the metaphor of it having happened before on the first ship. You can do it all without a burned man villain to come and do it for you. And that's how the film should fall apart. It should be, you know, a kind of a battle from within.
I mean, you're not wrong. And I don't know whether the film turned out as exactly as Alex Garland wanted. Danny Boyle on the commentary says that they worked on it, the script together, for over a year. And there were 30 drafts.
I wonder if in one of those drafts there wasn't a burned villain character. I mean, because he's so bad, Adam, that they go to extreme lengths to never show him properly because of how stupid he is.
Yeah, and that's also interesting because that is basically what happens in Event Horizon, but they do show it and it all gets really silly. In this, you'll be very interested to know that all of that blurring effect, the whole last third of the film, it was all done in camera on set. it's not retrospective, it's not stylized. Danny Boyle, he made Mark Strong get in 5 hours of 5 hours of makeup and then basically shoot him so it was more kind of, what's the word? I guess a bit more like it's an acid trip. Like it's, he wanted it to look like he was giving off this weird energy. So I love the fact that he made a creative decision. It doesn't come off.
No.
Because it's just really aggravating to watch. Now, Alex Garland, in a 2015 interview with IndieWire, he's talking about his filmography at the time. And in the interview, the guy says to him, "How do you feel about the end of Sunshine? Because I know a lot of people have problems with that film."
Yeah.
you know, that's a nice...
AKA, I think it's shit.
Yeah, and then Alex Garland says, "I do, yeah." The quizzer says, is that a writing compromise? Or, and Garland says, "No, it's holistic. Sometimes when I'm talking about collaboration with collaborators before we work together, I say, don't get this wrong. When I say collaboration, I'm not saying you're going to do it all. I'm saying we're going to collaborate. It will be a partnership, and that's the beauty of the collaboration. They make it better, and ideally, you also help in making it better. It's people working together, not working totally separately. That's also true when things go wrong, when things are elevated. It's because of a group of people working together, and when things start to fall down, it's for the same reason. What I see in Sunshine is I can see unresolved tensions. I can see different movies being made simultaneously, and I can see things that simply could have. It's so dangerous for me to talk about." So he stops answering the question, and then the guy asks him about Danny Boyle, and he says, "Would you ever work with him again?" And Garland says, "No, but I learned an enormous amount from Danny and I respect him hugely."
Huh.
"Danny has a terrific instinct towards viscerality and compulsion. Of course, viscerality and compulsion, if you're making 28 days, then you're both in perfect sync and perfectly riffing off each other as collaborators. Sunshine, in my mind, was closer to Ex Machina, tonally, and it had a more reflective quality." So this is it. This is where he really gets into it.
Yeah.
And that's where the tension here in Sunshine. And so Garland says, "Sometimes viscerality and reflection were fighting for space on that movie. It was like a balance issue." But then he also goes on to say, "The significant failings in Sunshine, from my point of view, were not in Danny's direction. They were in the script. They predated the shoot or editing. And what we were never able to do was fix the problems in the script because we had a different methodology in terms of how that fix might happen."
Presumably that means that Danny Boyle maybe thinks that he has means of fixing that when the film is shooting, but Alex Garland would rather fix that in the script itself. I want the Garland movie. I love Ex Machina. I want it to be that. I want it to be the same thing. Well, there we go. No, I do like The Beach, and I think we'll never get to do it on this podcast because it's quite a memorable movie, or at least it hasn't.
Is it?
Yeah, of course, man. It's in the fucking canon. It hasn't. I'll hear nothing about that. I'll hear nothing about it. It's in the canon.
Hang on a sec. It really isn't.
It is in the canon, mate. Come on.
It is not in the canon.
It's so in the canon.
It's absolutely fucking plumb out of the canon.
It's plumb in the middle of the plumb stone of the canon.
Okay, this is a great opportunity to remind listeners that we do have an email address.
Yeah, that's true.
The email is moviesyouforgotyouforgot@gmail.com.
Yes.
Tell us.
Subject line, The Beach. Canon? Question mark?
Subject line, The Beach. Canon? Question mark. Just subject line, The Beach. Subject line, The Beach. And then just tell us, is it canon or not? And if you don't know what canon is or not, you have to listen to the anger management. Is it the anger management episode?
God, I can't remember.
Where we just go through canon.
Maybe canon, it is, yeah.
Not canon.
It is canon because it's all, we canon. Base it around Nicholson.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's, you've got to listen to the anger management episode to understand what canon is, and there's very specific rules. If you don't know the rules, hey man, you can't play the game.
The thing is about that, and we disagree on it in the anger management episode as well. I believe that canon is everyone's choice. You believe that canon is your choice, right? And I think the distinct difference there is that people will just know in their heart of hearts whether it's in the canon or not. They'll know.
Canon is not my choice.
Yeah, no, you said listen, it was let's not your get into choice. It.
No, canon is not. I kind of raised it that
You think canon is like journalists' choice, the people who are in the industry who know. I think it's all people.
No, you see, this is the problem, because I hate journalists and I hate critics and I disagree with what their opinions are.
Yeah.
I do think canon spans...
Canon spans?
Yeah. What I'm saying is canon spans your individual taste.
Yeah.
Whatever I say about film critics, and as much as I despise them, and I do despise them, what I will say about them is they do at least watch movies and have watched lots of movies.
Yeah, yeah.
So they have a kind of a barometer.
And they say The Beach is in the canon.
I'm saying like they're more likely on the Venn diagram. Is it a Venn diagram? On a diagram of who knows what canon is.
Yeah.
I would align them, like they're going to kind of be a bit closer just because they're more, their snouts are in the trough. You know, my snout is in the trough.
Right. You're a little film piggy.
Yeah, we don't state what's in the trough. We just snuffle it up.
Let me tell you what's in the trough though, okay? The beach is in the trough. And the beach is in there because it's a good film, because it's got Leonardo da Caprio in it, and because it features heavily... Spinning Away. Okay, do you remember that Brian Eno song, Spinning Away?
You're such a clown. You don't know what canon is.
I do know what the canon is, and I'm telling you, Leo de Capricorn and his beach are in there. Yeah.
It's excised from the canon because there's the most
upon a hill. Remember that song?
There's the most appalling. Okay, forget it. Okay, let's get back on track.
When matters are holding moments into time. Shallow Grave, sure. Train Spotting, hey, great movie.
Wait,
what can I say?
Listen. We're not just going to make this about your opinions. Shallow Grave, and
we're gonna make it about yours.
This is where Boyle is. He's got a visual sensibility. In the words of Alex Garland, Danny has a terrific instinct towards viscerality and compulsion. And so and you certainly get that in Shallow Grave, Train Spotting. But what I felt like when he goes big and broad with Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah.
That's the film that makes him massive. And I shunned that film because it was so popular, because everyone seemed to love it. And then the way it was, it's like Dev Patel, and there's like everyone's smiling in it. And when I finally watched it, it's so dark and quite stressful. You know, there's a scene where a kid gets his eyes popped out with a hot spoon.
Yeah.
And I think that film's success has actually, that's an example where something that seems like it should be canon isn't, because if you tell, like, it's kind of become anti-canon because it was so popular, people reject it and almost don't know what it is anymore.
Sure.
It's like the idea of it has become what the film is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that's what he's really good at. You know, he's a populist, but really, really stylish, stylized, very good director.
I mean, if we look at the other films on this list as well, I never watched 127 Hours, but it received a lot of attention.
It's all right. The bit where he cuts his arm off is very well done.
Is it visceral?
Yeah, he manages to, I mean, it's almost like not worth making a film about, although there's a lot of films these days about, like, say, people falling off, jumping off their yacht and then being stuck in water and there are sharks about, or being stuck at the top of a tower, and that's the whole film. It's survival horror.
Yeah.
And he had some real class to it. Franco, though. Franco's cancelled.
All right, listen, all the way up to 2019, though, Danny Boyle makes a truly horrific film called Yesterday, which is the Beatles movie, and is not worth any time.
Right.
But he does make an excellent 6-episode TV miniseries called Pistol about the Sex Pistols, which I enjoyed.
He's got a very interesting filmography. It's ups and downs. It's gutters and strikes.
Let me tell you too. National Theatre Live, Frankenstein. He's amazing. That's a brilliant play. I like that.
You know, he's done his theatre stuff. He did the old Olympics. whatever the fuck.
He did the old Olympics.
He did the old Olympics opening ceremony that everyone, like, everyone was thinking, listen, before that opening ceremony happened, everyone thought the Olympics in London was going to be a big old pile of shit, and everyone was sick about how much money they'd spent. And everyone was expecting, the English mindset, to my mind, in my opinion, Johnny caveat, is we despise ourselves, we don't want anyone to look at us, and we expect failure, and we despise anyone who tries to put on a party. So the Olympics is the perfect opportunity for, like, why the fuck are we even having this? Who's going to come? Everyone's going to think we're a bunch of fucking morons. This is a piece of shit. Oh, my God. It's definitely going to be rubbish. It's definitely going to be rubbish. Oh, my God. And then when it was on, everyone went absolutely nuts. They said it was amazing.
Sure.
And I kind of dipped in and out of it, and it did seem like quite a spectacle.
They had the Spice Girls on top of some cabs.
They had Ken Branagh in a stovepipe hat.
Right.
A stovepipe hat.
Standing at the edge of the beach in Calais and saying, you can practically see home from here.
So, look, you go back in history. You look back in turning points in time.
You look back in time.
You look back in time, my friend, and that was a turning point for the English psyche.
Yeah, it changes the perception of Boyle as much as it changes the English psyche.
I genuinely do think that, you know, then the whole Olympic Games, everyone was going to everything. They loved it. Fine. Like, what are you going to say about Alex Garland?
I worked in a pub at that time. And let me tell you, I did not love it. I fucking hated it. And I was sick of everyone suddenly being involved. I also hate Danny Boyle for doing it. Because he did it very well, and he took people from a general feeling of ambivalence about it to being engaged in a soft power play on behalf of Boris Johnson and as the London mayor.
And what a lovely opinion to have. But isn't it interesting, like, what fair weather folk we are? You know, people's moods.
Because
it was palpable. You know,
oh, it was like heaving. It was
the
wet.
Derision. We were dry as a bone, and then suddenly wet as Niagara.
Would you like to play the box office game, Adam?
Hot diggity damn, would I?
Okay, well, here we go then. The film is Sunshine. The budget is...
Now, listen, I did say I'd listened to the Danny Boyle commentary.
Did they spill the beans in that?
I have a feeling that Danny Boyle might have opened up the tin of beans. I don't know whether he spilled the beans.
Oh, no.
He intimated what flavour the beans might be.
What the flavour is green.
If you look at this film, if I was guessing what this film cost, and I'm gonna forget what he said, I'm going to say it looks... Like, with all the special effects, it looks like it cost $40 million. But I have a feeling I know it didn't cost that.
You would have said $40 million.
I would have said $40 million.
If you didn't know better.
If I didn't know better.
And what better do you know?
It cost $20 million.
Well, the estimated budget I have here is $26
million. Okay, well, old DB, he dropped the 20. He said 20.
Right.
But 26 might be more accurate. I mean, it's the director talking on the commentary. What the fuck does he know?
Well, let's say 20 then.
And I know they spent 20 on marketing. I do.
Because DB said that as well, did he?
I do. I know that they spent 20 on marketing.
Boyle talked about the agency they used and some of the cool initiatives they ran with.
No.
Would you throw yourself into the sun to save mankind? If yes... Go and see this film, Sunshine. It's for you.
Right.
That was the ad campaign, wasn't it? And the billboards, just massive picture of the sun. But they put the billboards in front of the sun. So it was a sort of clever twist on the sun.
Clever twist on the sun.
Well, let's go opening first, US and Canada. Now, this is July the 22nd. It's a summer movie, 2007. What do you think? Is it bums on seats is the question.
This is not bums on seats. There are no stars. It's not an action film. It's not ostensibly even an American film.
Yeah.
You know, this is an Armageddon.
I guess Cillian Murphy's not a star, is he, at this point in his career?
Absolutely not. No. Yeah.
So Killian isn't getting bums on seats in US and Canada. What do you think the take is for that opening weekend?
5 million?
It's significantly lower than that.
Oh, man, that's bad.
Like, significantly lower
than that. Are we talking, like... We're talking
six figures, yeah.
Okay, so it's at least 1 million.
No, we're talking six figures.
Yeah, that's 1 million.
1 million is 7 figures.
No, it's not.
Well, 1 million has 6 zeros and 1.
Oh, right, okay. I just thought 6 figures. I thought the 6 figures thing's always referred to the zeros.
No. 6 figures is 6 figures in total, including the... hence, a six-figure salary is 100K or above.
I don't... Obviously, I've got it horribly wrong. What, 900?
No, it's $243,000 it took.
Oh, man, that's...
It's a real... I mean, talk about a big bomb on the end of a spaceship.
Oh, oof.
Woof.
Oof, McGoof.
Yeah, but gross worldwide, perhaps a little bit different.
I want to say the number that I hope it made. I want to say it made 40 million, but it didn't
quite. It made 35 million.
Okay.
So it's potentially washing its face, depending on what they did with the marketing.
It's not. They would have spent, they would have, you know, it might, maybe, if they cooked the books.
Talk about being close to the sun.
Mate, they flew close to the sun. And they got burned. What movies have you watched in the last week?
What a terrific question, Adam. And I'd be happy to answer it for you. I've only watched one since I hung out with you. Although we did watch one together that we could talk about. The Treasure of Sierra Madre.
Yeah, when we do get together, we do watch a Western.
Yeah, we enjoyed that with Humphrey Bogart. Very odd fish, isn't he? But also, well, I say we watched the first half and then I watched the second half of K-Pax for the first time.
that was because we had a massive argument because you didn't want to watch.
It wasn't that big, to be honest. It was actually quite small.
It was quite a huge argument because I really wanted to watch.
Well,
I kind of wanted to trick you into watching a scary film, but you thought it looked scarier than it actually was. Yep. A film called Triangle with Melissa George. I hadn't seen it in ages. It's really good. And I knew it wasn't that scary. I just, you know, it has tense moments. It's sold as a horror movie on the box. It's not a horror movie. It's about kind of, it's about time loops and it's spooky. It's on a big ship. And you push back and I push back. And then I said, forget it. let's watch some nonsense on Netflix.
Sure.
And then we were in the whole thing of like scrolling through Netflix.
We became a couple in that moment.
It makes me want to blow my brains out because I know there's nothing on there. And I bought about 10 DVDs.
Sure.
I bought Sorcerer and you went, oh, that looks scary. And I said, no, it's about a big truck and they're driving it. And you went, ooh.
That's the one you were trying to get me to watch, by the way. It wasn't Triangle.
Oh, right,
Sorcerer.
It was Sorcerer.
And you said it's about a car. And then I thought, well, that doesn't sound that fun.
And then we were arguing about Triangle, because basically you wouldn't take my word for the fact that it wasn't scary.
The thing is, I don't believe you, for a start. I'm not saying I don't now, but I didn't believe you in the moment. And also, I was very supportive of it, but you had chosen the film the night before when we were together.
But you hadn't bought any DVDs.
Well, no, but...
You bring a fucking DVD on holiday.
Yeah, but there's a whole internet, you know, there's a whole world of films that we could watch.
Yeah, but then you get lost in scrolling and they don't have anything good.
Sure, sure, sure. All I'm saying...
And you end up watching K-Pax.
I don't want to start... I enjoyed K-Pax. I don't want to start the argument again. God forbid.
Well, guess what? Sorry.
But, you know, it's a hard life, isn't it? Having to flick through streaming services with a significant other. It can be complicated. The other film I watched, by the way, which was in order to not do the very same thing with my wife at home, is the Meyerowitz Stories, which I've seen before, but it was a rewatch and my wife had never seen it before. It's a great little film.
Because we chatted about Sandler and then you got home and had Sandler on the brain.
And do you know what?
Adam Sandler
is great. He's great in this film. And he's really, like, Noah Baumbach has really given him the Baumbach treatment. Every time Sandler reaches 10, when he starts to scream, there's a hard cut to the next scene. And it happens 3 times in the film. It gets funnier every time. But also, I'd forgotten what a terrific job Dustin Hoffman does, but also how
Dustin Hoffman?
Yeah.
Is he in it?
Do you forget? He's the father in that film, yeah.
I Did
you remember that Emma Thompson plays his wife as well?
Forgot.
Completely disappears into the role, Emma Thompson. She's terrific. But no, Hoffman plays like this absolutely infuriating father character who's entirely... He's absent through narcissism. He's completely incapable of recognizing the lives of others in that film, and it's just
you mean they put on that German film?
Yeah, and he just can't see it.
He can't see it.
No, because he's still thinking about the war. He's not over it yet.
And they're all just thinking, "Hey, Pa, the movie's on.
Yeah,
and this won an Oscar, Pa. Why can't?" And Dustin Hoffman's going, "Well, I can't actually see. There's nothing on the screen." And they're like, "Pa, you got all the Germans. They got the Eastern Nazis there, and they're not Nazis anymore. I'm very confused."
Pa, you gotta let it go. You gotta let the war go, Pa.
I can't see anything on the thing. But we're showing you the lives of others, Pa. You can't see the lives of others. This won a goddamn Oscar.
That's right. So you're the kind of guy who launches into an excellent improv, but you play both parts.
I am that kind of guy.
Yeah.
Did your wife enjoy it?
Oh, the Meyerowitz stories?
Mm.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, she was looking for something that would distract her from her life, and I think it did. She's someone who, when looking for distraction, prizes stories that are like sort of more real and that could happen. Whereas I want to watch The Lord of the Rings. You know, I want to be on a different plane, but she wants to kind of be in a different mind that's in this world.
Yeah. A kind of human beings, a different borough, a different country.
She wants human beings, I want hobbits, you know? And I wanna really get inside the brain of a hobbit.
And do what?
I just wanna poke around in there, see what's going on.
I mean, you're massive. You would crush the brain of a hobbit.
Yeah, it would be a problem, I think, if it was a physical thing.
It would pulp.
It would pulp. Yeah. I think I'd be... I'm probably bigger than Gandalf.
Well, that's a real brag, man.
I mean, I'm taller than Gandalf.
You pick up the chicks?
That's how I get them.
Hey, I'm bigger than Gandalf. Yeah. And they just drop their trousers.
I'm glad that you used... Your story had the framing of antiquated misogyny, but in it the female characters were wearing trousers, so it's actually quite sort of weird combination of different times there, isn't it?
Hey man, that's not weird. Women wearing trousers isn't weird.
No, I'm also saying, yeah, it's good.
How's it misogynist that you can woo a woman?
No, of course. I'm just saying your setting of like picking up those chicks, as you call them, heading to the barrio. Yeah. Heading to the barrio to pick up those chicos, you know?
I got told off today for referring to women as birds.
Did you?
Yeah.
You were right to be told off. Who told you off?
Only my wife, so it doesn't count. Yeah. Doesn't count.
That's not a real telling off. What if it was like a teacher of one of your children who said, "Mr. Richmond, please don't refer to women as birds"?
Why? How has this scenario happened?
Well, because you've gone to a parent-teacher evening,
okay,
and the teacher is saying, "Well, your daughter is excellent at English," and you've said, "Oh, aren't you fucking bird? What else is she good at?"
Yeah,
and then that's when it's come up.
She says, "Now, Mr. Richmond, don't call me a bird."
That's right. Would you be embarrassed?
Yeah. I mean, I would. I would.
What if your wife was dead?
Tell me more.
Well,
then what? Well, can I just go out and do
whatever
I want?
No, in this scenario, the thing is, you're a single father and your wife has passed away not so recently that you are still bereft, but maybe sort of within the last 2 years, maybe at the 18-month mark. So you're functioning. You're sort of reaching the point where maybe you are thinking that there's, you know, you're contending with the fact that life is going to continue for you for a long time, and you're noticing other people around you, other women, and in this instance, this school teacher, this bird, she's a fine bird. She's sort of a blue tit. You know what I'm saying? Pride of the garden. Do you understand me? With a beak firmer than a crusty edge of cheese, but her wings are sleeker and better kept than the wings of many other birds, and her claws have talons that can grip to even the skinniest twig.
Right.
Okay?
Importantly.
And then you call her a bird, and she says, well, Mr. Richmond, I would tell you off, but I am in fact ontomologically a bird.
Anything off the trolley, dears?
Joe?
Yes?
Should we do the bit of the podcast where one of us reads out a long list of films and the other one has to say whether they forgot it?
I'd love to. And this week, I don't think it will be full of someone saying, I haven't seen that. I think it will be full of someone saying, I haven't forgotten that.
Oh, because it's my turn, isn't it?
And I'm going to begin with 12 Monkeys.
Oh, you are. I tell you what, you've been going great guns recently.
Yeah.
And you could not more have fucked your face up by saying that film to me.
Oh, shit.
You look like an absolute clown to say those words to me. I honestly, like the last few episodes, I was just like, this guy, he's got me. I'm on my back feet. I'm on my heels. I don't know what's what. He's going to get me. I don't know what I'm doing. And now you are, oh, brother, you could not have got that more wrong.
Legends of the Fall.
I've never seen it.
Never seen it. Okay, fine.
Love to have
Gravity.
Seen it.
We shouldn't say Gravity just because we've just done a space movie, but Gravity is on my list anyway.
I think that's too visceral and too good. You know what? So much of what we've missed a whole bit of chat about Gravity in this. The only time we could have ever talked about Gravity was when we were talking about Sunshine.
That's true, yeah. Maybe it'll come back around in the future. We might do another sci-fi where we can talk about Gravity. Yeah. How about The American?
Oh, Clooney to Clooney. Yeah. He's clooned to Cloon.
I've clooned to Cloon, mate. I've double clooned.
Now, I mean, I don't want to give you too much credit for this because I think you know. You're not guessing here. You know I forgot this based on...
I thought there was a good chance.
Casual chat. But it's a really great shout. This is pure movies you forgot.
You want to do it?
Absolute. Mate, I don't want to do it.
No.
But it's right bang in the center of kapow.
Do you know what? I think that's the quickest I've ever got you, though. We started with 12 Monkeys, which admittedly didn't go the way I hoped. But I got you within four, I don't have to recompile my list for next time now. It's amazing.
What in heaven's Christ did you think you were going to get from 12 Monkeys?
I just thought, for me, it's a film I forgot.
It's sci-fi, mate. You just proclaim to love sci-fi.
Yeah,
how
I do love
you?
Sci-fi, but I never really loved that film. It was a bit confusing for me. I watched it a couple of times, you know, when I was much younger. Haven't seen it since. Hasn't stuck with me. And then it popped up on a little list, and I thought, oh, maybe Adam will have had a similar experience. I did think you probably wouldn't, and it's the sort of film that you would like. But also, having said that, you know, I just edited an old episode in which I tried to get you with The Assassination of Jesse James. You said you describe it in your top 20. And then I rewatched it shortly after that because it's a film I'd forgotten. And I found it, I don't want to get into a long conversation or whatever, but basically I didn't enjoy it. And so I think it's quite good for the purposes of these conversations because I think our tastes just are quite different.
I mean, I can imagine if I go back and watch The Assassination of Jesse James, I might find it quite long and boring.
Yeah.
But I don't want to do that.
My second viewing as well.
I don't want to go back in time.
Don't go back. Don't go back.
But you should go back with 12 Monkeys.
Maybe I will.
It's a doozy.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll watch that. But also, we'll watch The American with George Clooney, which I remember being okay. Quite fun.
All right, that was a good one. Catch you next week, Joe. Bye.
See ya.